On this week's 51%, we speak with Minnesota Law School professor Jill Hasday about her book We the Men and how downplaying or forgetting women's struggles for equality perpetuates inequality.
Courts are most likely to give a rosy proclamation about women's status in America at the moment that they're denying women some right they seek.
We also hear from a lawyer and mom of five looking to increase awareness of the discrimination faced by parents with disabilities. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The Trump administration has targeted diversity, equity, and inclusion programs under the argument that in today's world, they actually provide an unfair advantage to women and people of color. Our main guest today says that argument is nothing new. Jill Elaine Hasday is the Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School, where her focus is on anti-discrimination law, constitutional law, family law, and legal history. Her latest book is called We the Men: How Forgetting Women's Struggles for Equality Perpetuates Inequality. Hasday says American history and laws still primarily center men, but the U.S. has been proclaiming otherwise for literally over a century. When you hear people respond to concerns about discrimination with statements like, "Oh, but women have it so much better today," Hasday says people have been saying that since before women even had the right to vote. And she lays out an interesting argument here, that downplaying women's struggles in history, forgetting them altogether, or exaggerating our progress on women's rights is a tactic, conscious or not, to perpetuate gender inequality. It prevents us from moving forward on all the things we still need to do, and in some cases, it even rolls back women's rights. If that argument rings true, then things like Women's History Month, Black History Month, and Pride Month, they look pretty important. In We the Men, Hasday includes examples of court cases throughout history where judges have praised the progress of women and in the same breath held them back.
I've actually been thinking about the seeds of this book since I went to law school. So many of my professors, when they told stories about the law, told the stories as if what happened to men, men's experiences under the law, were what the law was. That was the baseline. And then they either wouldn't mention women or they would treat women's experiences as a footnote, something to skip over quickly. And I thought, women aren't a sideshow. We're about half the population. As your show says, 51% of the population. Our experiences under the law are just as essential as men's experiences. And that's what first got me thinking about this book. The title of my book is We the Men, because the idea is we have a Constitution that purports to speak for we the people, but too many times the stories that powerful Americans tell about law and society only include we the men. Sometimes they actually use the word people, but they still only mean men.
Give me a few examples of something like that.
One of the examples that comes to mind most for me is because I'm a law professor, is it's very common for law professors to create lists of what are the Supreme Court's most important cases of all time? What are the Supreme Court's most terrible decisions of all time? And these lists are very important. They shape what cases are taught in law school classes, because there's obviously, you know, there's many more cases than you could ever teach. And there's not a single case about women's rights that appears on either of these many most important or most terrible lists. And I just think that's very telling. Women are not part of the mainstream story that law tells. Or I'll give you another example. So I told the story about law school as why I wanted my first thoughts about writing the book. But the reason I wanted to write the book now, and I decided to write the book now, is the 250th anniversary of the United States is coming up in 2026. And at all previous celebrations of milestone anniversaries, women have always been on the outside, sometimes literally clawing their way in and crashing the ceremonies. But one way you can see how these ceremonies have centered men is not only that it was men talking and men on the platform, but the story they tell is about You know, our nation was founded on the idea of government by the consent of the governed. That story is only true for a minority of people living in the early United States, meaning white men, especially white male property owners. It's simply not true for any woman or most men that they were guaranteed self-government. And I think, you know, freedom and self-government are important parts of the founding, but so is slavery and subjection. And telling a story of America that's only about the founders established government by the consent of the governed is telling a story that is only about white men.
When we tell stories that are centered around white men, what does that mean for women, for minorities? How does that actually shape the world that we live in today?
So the subtitle of We the Men is How Forgetting Women's Struggles for Equality Perpetuates Inequality, just to give you a preview. And one of the main arguments in my book is that forgetting women's stories is not only inaccurate, but it also helps keep sex inequality in place. So the book talks about two kinds of forgetting. One is just leaving women out of the story, and the other is forgetting that women still have a struggle ahead of them. I think anyone who lives in 21st century America has probably encountered someone who announces or assumes that the sexist battle days are behind. But one thing I discovered in researching this book is that those kind of victory announcements are more than a century old. Courts, politicians are announcing that sex equality is established even before the 19th Amendment and sex-based restrictions on the vote. And those premature declarations of victory don't appear at random moments. They actually are most likely to appear precisely at the moment that the power broker wants to deny women a right they're asking for. So, for instance, courts are most likely to give a rosy proclamation about women's status in America at the moment that they're denying women some right they seek.
Wow, yeah, you know, give me a few examples of that because before your book, I didn't know that.
So, there's a ton of examples. I'll do one from the mid 20th century, and then one from very recently.
Okay.
One of my favorite stories in the book is actually about this feminist lawyer in Detroit called Anne Davitow. And she challenges a 1945 Michigan law that banned women from being bartenders in larger cities unless they were the wife or daughter of a male bar owner. This so-called anti-barmaid law was part of a wave of legislation that the all-male bartenders union helped pass throughout the nation. Anne Davitow sues on behalf of four women. It's always going to be an uphill battle. At this point, the Supreme Court has spent generations upholding any restriction on women's labor, but she's undaunted. She takes the case called Gossard v. Cleary all the way to the Supreme Court. It gets there in 1948. She later reports that Justice Felix Frankfurter heckles her from the bench while advising her that the days of chivalry aren't over. He's either blind to the irony or thinks that her effrontery in bringing the suit excuses him from any obligation to act like a gentleman. And then, very shortly after the oral argument, he writes for the court a three-page decision that simultaneously dismisses the women's claim very contemptuously. At one point, he says, "To ask whether this law is constitutional is, you know, immediately to answer it," but simultaneously says women have achieved so much. And this case, throughout the 20th century, you see, I have tons of cases where the court is saying simultaneously, we won't give you equal rights, but don't worry, you already have so much. The most recent prominent example is actually from 2022 in the Dobbs case. That's the Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe and eliminated federal constitutional limits on legislative power over abortion. In the course of this enormous setback and rollback of women's rights, the court says, don't worry, taking all checks off legislative power over abortion is going to be fine. There's no more stigma against unmarried women. We have a tremendous social safety net. And of course, women have so much political power. Not surprisingly, this kind of argument depends on leaving out everything that makes it less true. For instance, the court in Dobbs makes much of the fact that women are a majority of registered voters, but doesn't mention that the Mississippi anti-abortion law that was at issue in that case was passed by a legislature that was over 85% male. In other words, these kind of statements of victory aren't just incorrect, but they're actually weaponized as a way of justifying and perpetuating inequality.
Well, kind of on the topic of Dobbs, you know, I'm wondering how you see this playing out in our current events today. You know, some things that kind of come to mind to me are the backlash to like DEI initiatives, We've got the SAVE Act, which we actually just talked about last week, and which could create some hurdles for women looking to get registered to vote. You know, the pattern that you write about, are you seeing that a lot today?
Yeah. First thing I want to point out is women are sometimes left out of the story, even when courts or politicians or other textbook writers talk about women. So for instance, one of the things the book talks about is what I call men's spontaneous enlightenment stories. And the idea is, don't worry, women didn't have to fight for anything. They just, men gave it to them in their wisdom. If you've ever heard, if you've ever read a textbook say men gave women the vote in the 19th Amendment, that's an example of that. So that, why is that story inaccurate? For two reasons. One, 19th Amendment ends sex-based restrictions on the vote, but it doesn't actually guarantee anyone the vote. Many women, especially women of color, are denied the vote after 1920. But two, the 19th Amendment is not a gift. It's a multi-generational battle. Women are literally being attacked as they picket outside the White House. It's bloody. Women are arrested, they're thrown in jail, they're force-fed, etc. The second thing I want to say when you bring up current events is the book talks a lot about commemorating women, or more specifically, women's absence from the commemorative landscape. And I think it's easy for people to assume, oh, that's kind of inertia. You know, no one thought of having statues for women, and then we just kind of keep old patterns. But really, one of the things I show in the book is that the reason there's so few commemorations of women is because there's been so many fights about it. And the reason there are so many fights about it is exactly what you alluded to, which is fights about commemoration are only partially about the past. They're really about the present and future. So for instance, the book talks about Donald Trump's opposition to placing Harriet Tubman on the front of the $20 bill since the Obama administration first announced that plan in 2016. Right now on the $20 bill, of course, is President Andrew Jackson. He was a slaveholder and he forcibly removed Native American tribes from their land. Harriet Tubman is one of the most amazing Americans who ever lived. She was an abolitionist and suffragist who freed herself and hundreds of others from bondage before becoming a Union spy, scout, and nurse during the Civil War. But Trump has dismissed efforts to put Tubman on the $20 bill as, this is his quote, pure political correctness. And certainly many headlines you see in the news today are about efforts to rewrite history. So the Department of Defense no longer celebrates Women's History Month or Black History Month. The National Park Service took Harriet Tubman's portrait off the webpage for the Underground Railroad until outrage forced them to put it back. Why are they going through historical memory? Because they know that historical memory shapes present thought and future action. Commemorations are important because they're about the future.
Well, in the spirit of remembering women's struggles for equality, what are some historical events that you feel are frequently misremembered or forgotten?
That's an interesting question. Well, I think the 19th Amendment is often remembered as like women, dainty white women in parasols, and people do not, it's not a question of forget. They never knew that how bloody it was and how much resistance there was, in part because the second the 19th Amendment is won, the men writing the textbooks immediately treat it as inevitable and not a big deal. It's only that in retrospect. I think we also forget that struggles over voting rights don't end in 1920 with the 19th Amendment's ratification. The U.S. doesn't take systematic efforts to extend voting rights to women and men of color until the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And of course, struggles over voting and voter suppression continue to this day. And I think one thing I think is powerful about these stories about America is that they can get into people's common sense, even if there's a way in which many people know they're not true. So I think we're all very familiar with stories saying, you know, women, the world is your oyster. You can achieve everything, even though we simultaneously know that there's actually a lot of systematic barriers that remain.
You know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Equal Rights Amendment, if you're open to it. Because, you know, it made some big news towards the beginning of the year. And I think the debate over the ERA is a pretty big example of how women are largely left out of the Constitution.
I have a lot to say about the ERA, as you can imagine. My book actually talks quite a bit about the ERA, in part because Phyllis Schlafly, the woman who's the most sort of famous leader of the anti-ERA movement in the 70s and 80s, made two central arguments against the ERA. One, that the ERA was unnecessary because America had already eliminated discrimination against women. And two, that the ERA was dangerous because it would unleash a parade of horribles, including same-sex marriage, and she had many other ideas. And one of the things the book shows is how anti-feminists have really stuck to her playbook, meaning when they counter feminist initiatives to protect abortion rights or extend government support for childcare, et cetera, they will often rely on this idea that these are unnecessary because sex equality has been achieved, and then simultaneously say it's dangerous because it'll change women's role in society. So the ERA has been in the news, as you said. When Congress sends the ERA out to the states in 1972, ERA opponents managed to insert a 7-year ratification deadline as part of the resolution sending the ERA to the states. I think ERA supporters don't fight that hard enough because they think the ERA is going to be ratified right away. It won't be a big deal. For instance, the Hawaii legislature is so eager to ratify the ERA that they're on the phone with someone in Congress. So the moment it passes Congress, they can be the first to vote for the ERA. But there's a powerful Stop ERA movement with Shafley as the most prominent figure. Although I think it's important to recognize that although she is the figure in front, almost everyone who actually votes against the ERA in a state legislature is a man. So it's almost exclusively male opponents that actually matter, but she does become the figurehead of and the, you know, and the important symbolic force of the movement. So when the deadline expires, there's only 35 of the required 38 states. But very soon, feminists come up with what they call the three-state strategy, and that says there's no ratification deadline provision in Article 5 of the Constitution, which governs amendments. Why should we accept the legitimacy of this ratification deadline? That's not part of the constitutional amendment process. Let's get three more state ratifications without starting over. So they managed to do it: Illinois, Nevada, and the 38th state is Virginia in January 2020. That happens during the first Trump term. His lawyers in the Justice Department immediately say, we're not recognizing these post deadline ratifications. Also, a number of states had tried to rescind their ratifications. It's very contested whether that works because, for instance, many states tried to rescind their ratification of the 14th Amendment, and that was unsuccessful. But the Trumpies say we accept all ratifications and we refuse to recognize any ratifications that are after 1979. In other words, the ERA hasn't been ratified. When Biden comes in, his lawyers in the Justice Department say essentially whether the ERA is ratified is not going to be decided by us. It's up to the courts and Congress. There are a number of efforts in Congress to pass a statute either removing the ratification deadline or just recognizing the ERA as part of the Constitution or both. They are not successful. They pass a few times when the Democrats control the House, but they don't pass both houses. And one thing that's really interesting, and one reason I talk about it in the book, is the arguments that anti-ERA people make in the last few years are exactly Phyllis Schlafly's arguments. The ERA is unnecessary and the ERA is menacing. Now their parade of horribles, they've moved on from talking about same-sex marriage because that's legal in every state. Instead, they say the ERA would provide constitutional support for abortion rights. There's some irony here because usually anti-abortion activists refuse to acknowledge any connection between abortion rights and sex equality, but here they do. So it doesn't pass Congress. In the very last days of the Biden presidency, there's a push to get Biden to order the archivist who has statutory control over recognizing amendments, who's part of the executive branch, to just recognize the ERA. Biden doesn't do it. Instead, he releases a statement saying, I personally believe the ERA's ratification is complete. Then Trump comes back in and he's definitely not going to do anything to recognize the ERA. But there's a lawsuit that's been filed where the person is challenging the constitutionality of male-only military registration under both the Fifth Amendment of the US Constitution, but also arguing that it's unconstitutional under the ERA. So it's possible a court will actually issue a judgment about whether the ERA is part of the Constitution.
So what can we do? Looking at the progress that still needs to be made on women's rights, aside from maybe the ERA, what would you like to see in our laws, in the stories that we tell one another?
So the book ends. I want to stress the book is not all doom and gloom. I end with like 35 pages in a chapter called Hope, which is about all the things we can do. And that spans teaching, commemoration, political representation, legislation, litigation, and everyday life. I think there are so many good legislative ideas. Coming up with ideas isn't the problem. The problem is getting them to pass. So, for instance, there are many, many studies showing that state laws preventing barring employers from asking about pay history before deciding what pay to offer decrease both sex and gender wage gaps. And a number of states, including Minnesota, have passed those laws, but not every state. And there have been efforts to get bans on pay history questions through Congress for the last 20 plus years, and it just hasn't passed. I think that would help. You know, the book ends with a section called Everyday Life because I do think that we all can make a difference in our everyday life, whether it's through public actions like voting or protesting, or private actions like talking to our friends, neighbors, relatives, family members. I hope that the book illuminates how forgetting women's struggles and the work the nation still has to do help promote complacency and perpetuate inequality. And again, my dream is that after reading the book, it'll be easier for people to spot these stories. Oh, you're telling a men's spontaneous enlightenment story. Or look at you, you're declaring equality at the very moment that you're denying equal rights. It's easier to spot it, to respond, and to call them out. I also think one of the lasting lessons of women's long history of struggle is that no important advance women have ever achieved has been quick, easy, or accomplished by anyone, no matter how amazing, acting alone. Generations of women have learned that lesson and persisted nonetheless. And I see the story this book tells as really cause for optimism in anti-feminist times because there's been many other moments in American history of regression, of rollback of women's rights, and women have persisted nonetheless. Sometimes the only way up is through, and it's important not just to look at what's happening this week or this month or this year, but to think, how can we mobilize across generations? Because that's the only way, usually, to achieve lasting change.
Jill Hasday is the Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School and the author of We the Men, How Forgetting Women's Struggles for Equality Perpetuates Inequality. It's out now through Oxford University Press. Jill, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
In Western New York, the family of disability rights attorney and activist Stephanie Woodward is getting national attention. Woodward and her husband, Ryan Chalmers, are wheelchair users living in Rochester who have been documenting their fertility journey and foster journey on social media. Recently, a TikTok video of their newborn triplets coming home from the hospital went viral, and soon after, the couple were featured in People magazine with the headline, quote, "Parents in wheelchairs welcome two foster sons, then baby triplets, how they show doubters the power in their journey," end quote. Woodward says she thinks what they're doing, parenting kids with love, is nothing remarkable, but she hopes the spotlight can accomplish something. She spoke with WXXI's Beth Adams.
I know you've wanted to be a parent for a long time. I'm so happy you're realizing that dream. How old are the triplets now?
They are just 9 months yesterday.
Why do you think so many people have been interested in your story?
You know, I think that's a great question. I do think that our story is unique in that we have two foster boys. We lost our first daughter. And now we have triplets, so it's certainly unique in that way. But I wouldn't say that having parents with disabilities is unique at all. In fact, like, disabled families exist. They exist everywhere. And that we've always deserved to be seen just like every other parent. But I think there's a lot of stereotypes and preconceived notions about parents with disabilities. And the way that Ryan and I show our lives really helps to dispel some myths and stereotypes.
Well, yeah, what are some of the misconceptions people have about parents, either like you and Ryan, who use wheelchairs to get around, or parents with any other kind of disability?
I think that there's lots of different stereotypes and stigmas, and some of the most common ones are that, like, just blatantly people don't believe disabled parents can or should be parents, that disabled people just shouldn't parent at all, that somehow we are unsafe, or that our children will have a lower quality of life. And it's simply not true. Whether you have a wheelchair or you have an invisible disability or any other type of disability, people are capable of being great parents. And we need to allow the space for us to do that and parent in our own ways. The way we parent may look different, but that doesn't mean it's wrong.
You've used your social media feed, I think, very well to demonstrate exactly what you're talking about. You just showed the other day how your whole family, all five kids, and you and Ryan were at, I think it was the Museum of Play. You've also showed how there are some adaptive items in your home that help you with the kids. Can you explain what some of those are? They're pretty cool.
Sure. I mean, one of the ones that most people are really interested in is our cribs. So we have adapted our cribs to have them have French doors. So we got standard cribs, and then with a couple of talented woodworking family members, we cut one side to be able to open and shut like French doors. So this allows Ryan and I to be able to get the babies in and out of their cribs without having to reach over the sides of them, which can be hard when you're short as a wheelchair user, but also putting a baby down when they're sleeping. So it's much easier to just slide them in and then shut the French doors. But we also use tools that aren't made for disabled parents, but are really great at being adapted and turned into accessible technology. So we have rotating 360 car seats. These car seats were made for any parent, but they work really well for parents who use wheelchairs because we're able to turn the car seat to be forward-facing when we're putting our babies in the car seats, putting them in, and then just pulling a switch to turn them around to be a rear-facing. And it's a lot easier than trying to strap a baby in while it's already rear-facing and having to contort your body.
That is genius, by the way, especially when you have three car seats to wrangle, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of car seats going around here.
You know, discrimination against parents with disabilities is an issue that sometimes comes up in custody cases or when people want to adopt or become foster parents. And I remember talking to you about this long before you became a parent. If more people see parents in wheelchairs or with other disabilities living life like any other family, can that eventually change?
That is our hope. As an attorney, I think I've talked to you about how I've represented parents who've experienced discrimination because of their disabilities, whether it's in a custody battle or whether it is because there is involvement from the county because of these ideas that disabled parents can't parent. And when we put ourselves out there, we do so very intentionally to try to change the world's conceptions about disability and parenting. So Ryan and I very much recognize that what we do is not special whatsoever. We are very mediocre, boring parents, just like most parents are. But by seeing us parent the way we do, just like every other parent, we hope that first, people who question us about our disabilities and our ability to parent will stop questioning. And those people can be your neighbors, but it also can be people in power, people in child protective careers, people in legal careers that often can work against us removing children from us. But we also hope to show this to parents or potential parents with disabilities. We want young people who aspire to be parents someday to see us and say, oh, this is possible for me and I can do this.
That was disability rights attorney Stephanie Woodward speaking with WXXI's Beth Adams. Thanks for joining us for this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.